Welcome back. This is part two of our GUCAST conference highlights from this year's EAU annual meeting here in Amsterdam. We're bringing you more highlights and interviews from the EAU, including a chat with Matt Cooperberg about the lutectomy study, which we presented in the plenary session here. Plus, we catch up with friends of the podcast at the inaugural GUCAST reception in an Irish bar here in Amsterdam. This one might best be enjoyed on YouTube.
So we're broadcasting live from Amsterdam for GUCAST. Johnny, what's been your highlight of EAU?
Look, it's been really fantastic to present to such a great crowd. The questions are really knowledgeable. Yeah. The people that were viewing it were the best in the world, the guidelines panelists. It was a real privilege and honour to share some of the work we've done down in Australia with them.
Same group.
Fantastic. Peter, you're one of our research students in the UK. What's been your highlight?
So that would definitely be learning how to drive a boat.
Nice. And you're doing a fantastic job at it.
Thank you.
Finn, do tell, what's been your highlight of the beautiful city of Amsterdam?
Really, really, really fantastic initiative. But really, the highlight for me is the fact that I really see the colour orange. So thank you for highlighting that, mate. That's the EAU.
Fran, last but not least, what's been your best bits?
I think the entire time. I think going a day early to get a chance to wander around town and see everything, do all the touristy bits, and then actually learn something during the conference. So thank you.
And my highlight has, of course, been catching up with friends, professional, personal time to really enjoy Amsterdam. Lots of love from all of us on the boat.
Okay, well, Declan, we are very lucky to have stolen a few minutes with this lovely lady here, Professor Maria Ribal, who really needs no introduction, but she's chair of the Uro-Oncology Department at Hospital Clinic in Barcelona and the chair of the EAU Guidelines Committee. Welcome, Maria. Lovely to see you.
Thank you for having me here. It's my pleasure to be with you.
It's been you've been busy at this conference. You've been here and there, and we've caught little sightings, but thank you for taking a few minutes to speak with us.
No, that's my pleasure. That's my pleasure. We should be able to find at least 5 minutes for friends.
Absolutely.
So this is great. Yeah.
Now, what we really want to talk about are the EAU guidelines. And you tweeted out this morning that it was wonderful to see the queues in front of the EAU guidelines booth. You know, everyone wanting to buy a little pocket guideline to take home. By the way, you need to save one for me. It must have been exciting to see that.
Honestly, I will say that. Say more than exciting, and thank you all, because this success cannot be done without you. But the truth is that after a year of working in the updates, it's really amazing to see that the guidelines are so well perceived, that people is waiting for them because they want them to bring it at home and to use them. So the truth is that I think that it's the maximum award for all the 300 people that it's working on the guidelines. Yeah. So I think that this is impressive and it's marvelous.
It's a marvelous job.
Exactly.
Isn't it,
exactly.
And you know, tell us about some of your plans for dissemination of the guidelines to make it, you know, accepted universally and you know, viewed by everyone. What are some of the things that you and the committee are thinking about?
Well, in 2014, precisely, it was established a proper dissemination committee for the guidelines. Mm. So we understand that our guidelines are nice. We are really happy with the product. But the truth is that if you are not able to spread your message, then your message is lost.
Yeah.
So it's not only to produce good guidelines, but to be able to disseminate them, to make them available for everyone, and then to apply them. So the first step for achieving implementation is just dissemination. So in 2014, we create the dissemination committee with different strategies, the endorsement for different national societies and special campaign for spreading our message into social media, because we need to change the way that we speak to people. And now social media is a good way to do so. So we were pioneers at that moment, just to put our guidelines there. So now we have not only Twitter messages, because it started like tweet. Now it's not a tweet. Now it's Instagram, it's Facebook, our podcast, not as marvelous as you, as your podcast, but there are podcasts. So there are different initiatives. There are the cheat sheets that is a very, very visual summary of our guidelines, and we spread them in several platforms and even on the web. So the strategy has grown up, And now we have a proper dissemination strategy that I think that it's key if we want to arrive to people. And I would say not all to those that already know them, but those that still doesn't know how important and how marvelous our guidelines are.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, EAU guidelines, this big international guideline, you know, you are renewing and reviewing all the time. But we still find that there are so many smaller societies who are almost trying to reinvent the wheel, really, by having their own set of guidelines. Why do you think that is? And how can we stop all that confusion?
Well, I would say we cannot prevent everyone to try to produce guidelines. But I would say that EAU guidelines are well followed, that in Europe there are not too many societies already producing their own guidelines. And what we found more and more is people translating our guidelines in their own language. Because it's true that sometimes it's difficult to follow a guideline on English and they translate to their own language. So I think that this is a good idea. And another thing is that you can do another process, that is to adapt our guidelines to your own reality, that it's a completely different process of the translation, is the adaptation, and this could be done and we can be of help of that. I think that the European guidelines can be adapted to different realities. It's true that in Europe we have very different health systems, but the base of our recommendations, I think, is applicable around Europe.
Yeah, wonderful. And recently, Maria, you were at our USANS conference in the Gold Coast. I mean, we sadly couldn't see you in person, but you were there in spirit and, of course, virtually. And you gave a fantastic talk about the updated EAU guidelines for bladder cancer. And it was so thorough and it was, you know, very comprehensive. And you also introduced us all to that risk calculator. And we all thought it was fantastic. I got a lot of feedback that it was really good. And how's the uptake of that been?
Well, the truth is that this is a work that the EAU guidelines have been investing for too many times, because you know that the risk stratification of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer have been there till 2006. And they decide lastly to review and to collect individual patient data. And they were able to collect data from more than 3,000 patients. And just to rebuild a new classification, I think that the strategy was good. Why? Because they recruit data on primary tumors, not treated. And we have heard, look, the new risk stratification of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer done by the EAU is not accurate because it overestimates the progression in those patients treated with BCG. And I think that the key of this calculator is that gives you upfront before you decide on any therapy, which is the real one non-muscle invasive disease that deserves an aggressive therapy.
Yeah.
I think that we need to understand that we need to invest in treating very, very aggressive non-muscle disease to prevent a muscle invasive disease. So I think that in this sense, the non-muscle invasive risk stratification is great, and you found it on a web, and you find it on your phone.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's an iPhone or an Android or whatever you want to go, want to have. You can use it, and it's an app, and it's quite easy. Yeah. You only need to put age, size, grade, and you can use both grade classification. So I think that it's quite easy to be used.
It's foolproof.
Exactly, exactly.
Wonderful, Maria. Well, you know, we love everything you do. You're an inspiration to all of us. Congratulations on all you've achieved, and thank you for chatting with us.
Thank you to you for inviting me again to your podcast. It's my pleasure.
Sláinte.
I'm going to have to chew this down.
Oh, that's good.
It's good? How do you rate it?
Thanks, Amy.
Welcome to GUcast. You're here at the GUcast reception in an Irish pub in Amsterdam, no less, of course. So, Ben Charnacombe.
Well, this is a famous pub for me because I've met some of my favourite urology characters in this pub a few years ago when David Boucher-Hayes introduced me to the Australian crew, and I then got my my fellowship with Tony Costello. So, we're great to be back here in Amsterdam, and actually the science has been great. I've been to a couple of things today. We've got ex-president of Baus, gave a masterclass in kidney surgery, metastatic resection this morning, and then David Boucher-Hayes. That's Tim O'Brien, and he's on camera now.
We're
We're live on GUcast TV, Tim. So, Marcus, you spent some time in Melbourne, but how does this compare to Sheffield?
Obviously a lot better.
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, I wasn't. I was expecting an intro about Melbourne, and what I was going to say is during my lockdown there, Dan Murphy's became a foothold for me because that's where you got your booze from, stockpiled for a happy life.
And there's a Dan Murphy's bar over there.
So I selfied next to it going, Dan,
you're in the wrong pub.
That's how I kept my life, you know, my marriage going.
Oh, dear. What's this place called again?
Hoopland or Hoop Man. Hoop Man. I'm a basketball fan, so that fits well.
So what are you most looking forward to in EAU 22?
To be honest, catching up with colleagues and friends. You know, it's been a long time coming. It's really nice to be here with all you guys. Sharing a session tomorrow, talks today. It's just been nice to be back in person in Europe. I've been to Amsterdam many times, but this feels different. It's good.
It is great, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how many former Melbourne fellows do you think are present in this?
Five, six, seven? It depends if you count the colorectal guys.
Yeah, I think that's about
a good
right.
number. A good
it's great
number.
To be here, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
So, would you believe it? We come all the way to Amsterdam for the EAU annual scientific meeting, full of urologists and specialists in GU oncology, and I bump into a bunch of colorectal surgeons from Melbourne.
Your future colleagues.
Future and past present, etc.
So, current colleagues.
Patter Waters, colorectal surgeon who worked in Melbourne, now
yes.
back in Ireland.
Yeah.
Jacob McCormick, still a colorectal surgeon in Melbourne at Peter Mac. Jake, how are you?
I'm well.
And Ollie, who was a colorectal surgeon at Peter Mac, now at MD Anderson in Houston. Yeah. So, gee, Renu, you know, you think you get away from it all, and now
variation.
Now they're here. Are you lost? Are you at the EAU meeting, Patter, or what?
No, we're at Pelvics. Where actually we need more urological involvement in pelvic. So set up about 5 years ago, we were looking at exenterations for both urological, gynae and rectal malignancies. And consensus is right now that we need more involvement from different disciplines. So urology need to come to the next pelvics, which is 2023 in Bordeaux, this time next year.
Well, it sounds like a great idea, Jake, but you're not actually at the EU. You're at an Irish bar in Amsterdam on Friday night. It's, I mean, you have found urologists. Congratulations.
It's funny the places you sort of end up when you're overseas. There's nothing like an Irish bar.
Yeah. And so pelvic sounds interesting, I must say, because we all work in the pelvis, and a lot of unfortunate patients have complex conditions. It's a cervical cancer involving the bladder, a bladder cancer involving the rectum, and so on. So it does make sense that pelvic specialists should work together. You know, colorectal surgeons, urologists, gynecologists, plastic surgeons, vascular surgeons. So,
yes.
And you do a lot of that back at Melbourne.
Yes, I mean, so Pelvics was set up as a pelvic generation collaborative, and it was done originally on some data that sort of showed that there's quite a various discrepancy in some of the outcomes that different institutions were getting, it's got a small group of people, and it's really much more designed around sharing information and techniques rather than actually being in competition, which is why it's a really nice meeting to be at, because there's a lot of discussion back and forth. Most of the sessions actually, instead of having a panel discussion, it's actually a group discussion of the delegates that are there. So there's quite open and free discussion, and there's not always consensus as to how things should be managed, but we expect that, and that's how things will grow.
But that's probably a marker of the degree of heterogeneity in what people are doing. And I think one of the issues is that we're trying to get, I guess, more homogenous data, and what we're probably trying to do is come together as a group to find out where we actually can create like homogenous data and where we can do that globally, you know?
So Ollie, at MD Anderson, obviously gigantic global cancer center, you see these complex patients all the time. It's very different even just from a scheduling point of view to all day operating this very complex, difficult cancers. How does it work at MD Anderson? Do you work closely with your urologist? We know the urologist at MD Anderson very well. Gynae, plastics and so on. How do you manage these complex pelvic cancers?
I mean, absolutely. So, I mean, obviously it depends on the disease site. So if it's a colorectal primary, then we'll be seeing them and we'll then liaise with our colleagues. But obviously if it's a urological malignancy, then they'll be the team that will be liaising with us. But I mean, it's so important to have the multidisciplinary team. We can't do these cases without everyone's help. And then it's also managing the complexities post-operatively as well, which is where we need the experts. So.
Fantastic. So there you go. It's a big multidisciplinary pelvic oncology love-in, quite by accident here in Amsterdam. We've got the urologists and the colorectal surgeons all working together. So where's Pelvics next? It's 2 years'
it's
time?
Bordeaux. This time next year, 2023, yep. Bordeaux.
Okay.
Next year, and then Stockholm in 2024, and Melbourne maybe in 2025.
Ah, fantastic. There you go. You heard it first on GUcast. They're all avid listeners and watchers of GUcast, of
Absolutely.
Course.
Absolutely.
joined here at the EAU Trade Exhibition Area by my old friend, Professor David Boucher-Hayes from Galway in the west of Ireland. Dave, good to see you.
Great to see you, Declan. It's been far too long.
It has. Nice to be back at an EAU in person, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's great to be amongst our friends. Yeah. You miss this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a social butterfly type of person, and I so much enjoy the interaction that we get. And you find that an awful lot of thoughts and decisions and what changes your life, as when we, both of us, were young trainees. Not that we're too old now, but we've moved on a little bit. But a lot of those decisions and conversations were had outside of lecture theatres.
Yeah.
And I think many of the big decisions that you and I both made and the interests that we developed were because of just the mixing of minds and ideas and meeting other people who just had great energy and drive.
And you make great connections that way.
Yeah.
So I feel sorry for younger people trying to, you know, get that link to a fellowship program or this or that, because you can't do that on Zoom, can you? So these meetings are great to be back. And look, you're a keen supporter of GUcast. I have to thank you. We've been running for more than 2 years now, myself and Renu. And since the very get-go, you've been sending us nice messages. You listen to all the podcasts, and therefore it's great to have you on. But you're enjoying GUcast?
Oh, absolutely. It's been a fantastic innovation. I think you guys have taken to it really well. It's very difficult to transition skills and to take it up so well. There must be a learning process in it, and I see that this is your new career. If anyone can see Declan's badge, he actually has press centre access on it now. So no longer just a urologist, but a double threat, and possibly becoming a triple threat, academic, working surgeon, now journalist as well.
It's just the way it is. Style over substance. Now, the reason we're here at the robot stand is you go right back to the very start of robotic surgery. I remember you influencing me, even me, who's been in this for a long time. And when you were down in Melbourne in 2003 doing your fellowship, that was the time that robotic surgery was just starting in Melbourne, which again was in Australia rather, which was really the start of it around the world. Back in 2003, you were finishing your training and down in Melbourne with Tony Costello. Do you want to tell us your memories of that first case, December 2003?
Yeah.
20 odd years ago.
Yeah. Middle of summer, of course, in Australia.
Yeah.
Everyone would have thought it's a dark December day. But we had Tom Allering, the great Tom Allering, come over from UC Irvine, from California. And it was a lot of trepidation, but a lot of excitement. The case, Tony did it, and I remember clearly that he burst a small blood vessel in his eye after the case because of the amount of pressure he felt under. But I did something that I think is a lesson to all young trainees when you're doing a fellowship, especially when you're like me and you go for 1 year and stay for three. You have to become important. So there was someone else who was trained to be the assistant and had gone on the course. But I turned up at 6:15 a.m. and he turned up at 7:30. And I was sitting in the chair. So I lay claim to the fact that I was the first assistant on the first case done in the Southern Hemisphere. 4 hours into the case, I was removed and substituted for Hotto Haxamola. But I think that's a valuable lesson. There's only one time to be first.
Yeah.
You know, you can only be first once.
Good lesson.
And then after that. But, you know, Tony's enthusiasm, Justin Peters' enthusiasm, teaching us all, training us all, just really made you feel this is where we need to be. This is an exciting, innovative area. And through that, I've developed great friendships with European urologists like Alex Mottry and Vipul Patel in Orlando, who's holding a meeting at the moment, who invites me over on faculty every year. And you meet the great and the good, and you learn.
And the thing,
as we were talking with Tim O'Brien just recently about, training doesn't stop when you finish training. That's really when it starts. And I think that's a valuable lesson that we all should realize.
And the thing back in those days as well, it wasn't so much about a learning curve. I know people talk about a learning curve for robotic surgery now. Back then, there were no videos. There were no experts. Tom Allering had come from California. He had done like less
75
cases, right? And there were no videos. So it was a discovery curve. I remember someone else, I can't remember who I can credit with that, a discovery curve. So compare that to today when there's all these live surgery meetings and videos available. It is a great opportunity for people. But I wanted to finally ask you about the technology.
technology, because we're here with these, we're on the Intuitive stand, it's the Da Vinci Xi systems, there's an SP system knocking around somewhere, and then competition now in the market, Medtronic have a big presence here with their Hugo robot as well. So, what, you know, 20 odd years on since that first case, Dave, where do you think we are with this technology? Has it really improved a lot, do you think, or is it, should we have already made a breakthrough to, you know, more sort of AI integrated type of robotics?
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. Yes, it has improved. You only have to go back and look at the videos. I have a compilation of complications video from early on in my own career, and you look at the quality of the image and the instruments and you know, the size hook. Of and the hook. Well, thankfully I never had to use the hook, but you know, that was about, and so there has been marked improvements with that, the protile, you know, the image in image, those sort of things I think have become helpful, but there haven't been the game changers that really we would have hoped that they would have been. Single port has a role, but I'm not sure what it is yet from my relative lack of experience. I don't think it's going to distribute itself as much as multiport has, because it's just much more accessible for multiple different specialties. The introduction of competition is going to make a huge difference in what I think we're going to see is more appreciation of the ergonomics. So there'll be masses of data will be accumulated, we'll be able to see how to make yourself more efficient. So you won't just be looking at videos, you'll be looking at performance analytics that'll be crunched by the big companies that are involved. Hopefully it'll affect price, specifically in the developing world. And I think one of the things that we all were very excited about at the very beginning with the concept of all of this was the remote operating and teaching. And that has come on leaps and bounds recently with Proximy and various other systems like that. So I think we'd like to see that expand more because it can be a very lonely place to be a robotic surgeon when you're miles and miles and miles away from anyone else, and you're the only other robotic person trained in the hospital may have gone on holiday and you run into a problem. So it would be great to be able to ring someone up and, could you take a look at this? You know, where's the help center? So I think those sort of things will have an influence on a very practical level. Are we going to see this further minimization? I think that will depend on where surgery itself actually goes. So are we actually going to reduce what we're operating on from organ to cell? And that may be the steps that we're going down over the next 10 to 20 years, where we're not taking out cancers, where we're injecting specific areas, or we're even doing partial prostatectomies, etc., as has become a little bit in vogue now. And robotics are...
I'm sorry.
Is that the devil's work?
Partial prostatectomy.
There are reported cases of it.
Okay, so just to be very clear, folks, we're not suggesting we should be doing partial prostatectomy. Boucher Hayes was doing a fantastic job then. I was nodding. You were talking about saying partial prostatectomy. Okay. I'm so old-fashioned. I think we should either just take the whole thing out or leave it in there completely.
No, I hear you, but it's fantastic.
Well, I do remember an oncologist saying that we have known for a long, long time that the best way to cure a cancer of a solid organ is to remove the solid organ.
Yeah.
And when oncologists are telling you that, as you know, in every area we've minimized that. We don't do radical mastectomy, we don't do radical nephrectomy, everything gets smaller and smaller. So there may be opportunities for that. Someone has to look at it. You know, I prefer to have surgical focal therapy rather than non-surgical focal therapy, if you know what I mean. But technology is a part of all of our lives and part of everything that we're involved in. You know, you check in for your flight online, you check, do your menu online, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, renew your passport online. So it has to be involved in the surgical field as well. And minimizing and minimally invasive surgery is something that I grew up with in my own family. My father was an innovator in minimally invasive surgery, and that's where I got my love for it and thinking, you know, we have to be able to reduce the amount of trauma that we do to get at the operative site that we want to be at, that this huge incision. So I've been delighted to be involved in robotic-assisted minimally invasive surgery. It was a real community effort in my part of the world, in Galway. A great friend of Galway's and a man that you would have known, Michael Heaslip, he said to me one night in a pub, as many things do happen in Ireland, I said, we're trying to raise $2 million to buy this robot in a very small hospital on the west coast of Ireland. He said, I'll get that sorted out for you. And within 3 months, we'd bought the robot and installed it, and we were the first people in Ireland. So my colleague Paddy O'Malley, who you know well, was the first surgeon to do a robotic prostatectomy. Yeah. And once again, I was the first assistant.
So well done, Dave.
Always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
That's not true.
I was the second surgeon to do one.
Great to chat to you, Dave, and maybe we'll find our way out to the west of Ireland sometime and go and visit you and do a podcast out there. It'd be great.
Yeah, well, so. You have to return home sometime, indeed, Professor Murphy.
Thanks so much. Great. Thanks, Dave. See you later.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Good morning. I'm Matt Cooperberg, and it's a pleasure to bring you a special edition of the Euro Today Center of Excellence for Localized Prostate Cancer. I am joined today by two friends and colleagues, Declan Murphy and Renu Epen from the Peter MacCallum Institute in Melbourne, Australia. And a special thanks to Declan in advance for borrowing his recording equipment. We would normally expect to see drones flying around giving us various perspectives, but it is really a pleasure to be here at the EAU meeting in person in Amsterdam. And what we're going to be talking about today is some very exciting research which Mr. Murphy and Ms. Epen will be presenting about the lutectomy trial, a neoadjuvant protocol using lutetium PSMA for men with high-risk prostate cancer. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And tell us a little bit about this trial. What was the inception? How did this come to pass? And what will you be presenting at this meeting?
Well, two things, Matt. As you well know, unfortunately, biochemical recurrence rates remain very high for men undergoing either surgery or radiotherapy for high-risk localized prostate cancer. We've known that for years and years. And unfortunately, no neoadjuvant strategies have succeeded in changing that. So lots of randomized trials combining ADT with AR pathway inhibitors or chemotherapy and so on have not really shifted the dial. So standard of care remains surgery or radiotherapy and then wait for the biochemical recurrence, which happens in 30 or 40% of patients. And at the same time, of course, lutetium PSMA has emerged as a very exciting option for men with more advanced cancer, as your Centre of Excellence in Euro Today has really documented very nicely. So we know men with MCRPC have very good tolerability and good outcomes from two large trials now, therapy in Australia and Vision in the US. So, of course, the question is, could we merge both these issues, the unmet need of high-risk prostate cancer and the exciting emerging therapeutic option with lutetium? So there are a number of trials, including in our center, bringing lutetium PSMA forward, but this is the way forward one, the lutectomy trial. So this is a neoadjuvant study where we give lutetium PSMA prior to surgery. And at this meeting, we're presenting our initial results for the first 10 patients.
And how... First of all, has this been an easy recruitment? Have patients been excited about the concept?
Well, patients have been excited and we've been excited, I think it's fair to say. But we opened bang in the middle of COVID in Melbourne. We opened in May 2020 when Melbourne was totally shut down. We had a really, really prolonged lockdown. But despite that, this trial recruited way ahead of expectations. So we're now fully recruited. It's a phase 1-2 20-patient study. The first 10 patients get one cycle of lutetium PSMA 617, so from Novartis, followed by prostatectomy and node dissection 6 weeks later. And the second cohort of men, they get two cycles separated by 6 weeks, followed by surgery. And it recruited really well. We had no issues. And at this meeting, we're reporting the data from cohort A, so those first 10 men who received one cycle, but the other men are fully recruited, and the last chap will undergo surgery in about 3 months' time.
And what can you tell us so far? So how has the experience been with those 10?
Yes, so the primary endpoint of the study was dosimetry. So that's what we wanted to see, is could we deliver a meaningful dose of radiation into the prostate and or lymph nodes with this strategy of giving 5 gigabecquerels of lutetium PSMA 6 weeks prior to surgery. So they had 3-point dosimetry done over the 72 hours following the lutetium injection. So that's the primary endpoint. And then, of course, other important secondary endpoints like safety, the safety of the lutetium, but also the safety of the surgery. Is it safe to do the surgery? Was very important, and of course pathological response rate, PSA response rate, and so on and so forth. So dosimetry, that's what we're presenting here at the EAU for the first time, and what we showed is yes, we can certainly get an adequate dose of radiation into the prostate and the lymph nodes. We showed the total maximum median absorbed dose is about 50 gray into the prostate and about 50 gray as well into the lymph nodes. So that's a meaningful dose. That's what we were aiming for with one cycle. We'll see what two cycles will bring, or more cycles in the future perhaps. And also it's very safe, because we measure to see, are we also getting dose into other places like salivary glands or the kidneys? And what we also report is very, very low dosages getting in there, very low exposure to the marrow and so on.
And the lymph node dose obviously depends on how much cancer is involving the nodes, presumably. Is that, so the 50 gray, this is for patients with relatively significant nodal involvement, is that right?
Yes, 40% of the patients had node involvement on PSMA PET-CT, but there are challenges in measuring the doses. You know, we're very experienced at measuring dosimetry in patients with very metastatic cancer in our center, but there are these partial voluming effects when you're trying to measure small organs like prostate and especially lymph nodes. But it's still very interesting because Renu is doing a PhD on the immunology of this. You know, what is the effect on the tissue, which is very exciting, and we'll see that. But we definitely measured some very high doses, up to close to 100 in some patients, and we saw dramatic images, as you saw here at the meeting, with these lymph nodes almost disappearing, PSAs coming down in about 40% of patients, and importantly, the surgery was not compromised. So, of course, being a surgeon yourself, you know, if you are getting 50, 60, 70 gray into the prostate, where there's a big, you know, gray group 5 cancer, does that mean surgery is going to be more difficult? Is the prostate going to be all fall to pieces, be all mushy? And thankfully, that's not what we saw, and we showed some examples here at the meeting where even despite the high doses of radiation that's getting into these tumors, surgery is not compromised. The surgery was all very straightforward. Patients recovered very well, thankfully. No compromise from their functional outcomes. So I think that's the conclusion for me, is that, you know, we showed we can get adequate doses in there. We see some very interesting responses. The surgery is very safe, and I think it makes us feel more determined, I think, to see where would you take this now? Higher doses, more cycles, combined with something else, and this is probably the start of that journey.
Very exciting. Now, tell us about the correlative. So, obviously, one of the huge advantages with the neoadjuvant strategy is access to tissue before and after, right? So, what have you been doing with this, and any preliminary findings or excitement you can share with us?
Some exciting findings. I mean, the findings from the trial itself have been fantastic, but the translational work that the trial allows is really exciting. And you know, as you know, prostate cancer really typically has a very immune cold and microenvironment, and you know, external beam radiotherapy kind of has a bit of an annihilating effect. And what we want to see is whether this kind of novel radioligand treatment that targets just the cells but with little collateral damage can kind of activate the immune system. And, you know, is there antigen presentation happening? Yeah. Is there T cells that are trafficking back to the tumor and having an effect? Is there a systemic effect with the tumor draining lymph nodes? So, you know, I think looking at the tumor microenvironment, looking at gene expression, you know, what immune subsets are now present after treatment is really exciting. So far we're seeing some very heterogeneous results. I mean, the patient numbers are low, but the tissue that we have access to is just incredible and allows us to do these, to do such amazing experiments on them. And, you know, being able to compare pre-treatment biopsies to post-treatment radical prostatectomy specimens is an investigator's dream, right? The ample amount of tissue that's available. And then being able to have access to these lymph nodes and looking at what happens to the tumor-draining lymph nodes is really exciting.
So is there anything you can say yet about this heterogeneity? Is this driven by differential PSA uptake, or is this innate biology or differences in immune response?
We don't TBD. Know. It's TBD, exactly. Okay. And I think and when we run the second subset of patients, the second group of 10 patients, we'll get a lot more information. I think it'll really kind of solidify the changes that we're seeing. And, you know, the comparisons we're making is not just pre and post-treatment, but also one dose versus two doses of lutetium PSMA. And then the really exciting thing is to be able to correlate all those translational changes to see what's happening. You know, does it correlate with the clinical findings? Yeah. So, really exciting work.
Very exciting. And then what's next? So, assuming safety from both phases of this, will you go on to a phase 3 in Australia? Will there be a multinational? What's next on the horizon here?
Yeah, I suppose that's what we're excited to do now. We have the cohort B, the second part of lutetectomy, will read out in the first couple of months of next year, along with the full paper on this experience. But now we've seen some stuff and we're sharing it here. There's a lot of discussion. We're talking to you and many others around the world about what you might do next. But I think there's certainly enough there to say, you know, in these high-risk men who have high biochemical failure rates, lutetium is safe. Some very interesting signals. We should probably be planning some sort of randomized trial up against standard of care, which is nothing, and let's see.
Right.
And whether we should combine it, lots of questions, I think. But I think lutetium's got certainly a research opportunity in early prostate cancer that we should do our best to explore.
Very exciting. Well, congratulations to you both on a very exciting trial and lots of great work ahead.
So thank you.
Thanks for sharing your time and your audio equipment.
Fantastic. Thank you.
So that's it for this episode of GUcast coming from the EAU in Amsterdam. What a terrific few days. I have to say, it is so nice to be back with in-person meetings, catching up with old friends, meeting new friends, and seeing some of the really great science that has continued to go on despite the pandemic. I'm back here in Doha, on the way back to Melbourne. Renu has gone off to Italy for a week. She's visiting Stefano Fanti in Bologna and also going to San Raphael in Milan as visiting professor, as a guest of professors Alberto Briganti and the great Francesco Montorsi. So I'm sure she'll bring us some highlights when she gets back down to Melbourne. Hope you enjoyed our coverage. As ever, please send us suggestions for stuff you want us to talk about here at GUcast. Take care.